Good afternoon, and welcome to the concluding program in the 2005 series of Fireside Chats of the Securities and Exchange Commission Historical Society. I'm Teresa Gabaldone, Professor of Law and Carville Dickinson Denson Research Professor of Law at the George Washington University Law School, and host of the chats this year. The Securities and Exchange Commission Historical Society is a nonprofit organization separate from and independent of the SEC. The Society preserves and shares the history of the SEC and of the securities industry through its virtual museum and archive at www.sechistorical.org. Today's chat will be preserved in the museum, so you can listen to the discussion or read the transcript later. Today's fireside chat looks at professional responsibility for practitioners of law and for practitioners of accounting. Joining me today are Barry Melanson, President and CEO of the American Institute of Certified Public Accountants, and Thomas D. Morgan, Oppenheim Professor of Antitrust and Trade Regulation Law, the George Washington University Law School. Tom also is one of the best-known authors and teachers in the field of legal ethics. The 2005 Fireside Chat series is made possible, in part, through the support of Pfizer, Inc. The remarks made today are solely those of the speakers and are not representative of those of the Society. Our speakers cannot give investment or legal advice. Barry and Tom, welcome. I'm sure that we can assume a fair amount of sophistication on the part of our listeners today, but not omniscience, so it probably would be useful to provide a little background. To do that, I'm going to ask each of you to answer two questions about your respective disciplines. First, in the case of accounting, Barry, what bodies of laws and or sets of rules govern the conduct of those practicing before the Securities and Exchange Commission?
Well, there's a series of laws. Obviously, you first point to the section or Rule 102E of the Securities and Exchange Commission, where an accountant or a CPA is required to be professional and adhere to a whole myriad of standards. So 102E would say that it would prohibit unprofessional conduct by an accountant that is either intentional misconduct, recklessness, repeated acts of negligence, or single acts of negligence that might reflect a significant departure from what is known as generally accepted auditing standards. When we focus on the terms generally accepted auditing standards, then we get into a whole new series of responsibilities or layers. Today, the Public Company Accounting Oversight Board, the PCAOB, has under Sarbanes-Oxley authority to set those standards for the audits of public companies. And so that body of knowledge, that body of rules, would be what a CPA would have to adhere to in the conduct of an audit of a public company. Those rules today are predominantly the historical auditing standards that were promulgated by the profession, promulgated by the AICPA, because when PCAOB was formed, it adopted those rules en masse, and then over time it adopts additional rules as it sees fit in the protection of the public interest. From an ethical standpoint, there is also a series of rules of conduct that the CPA must point to. Some of those would be contained in action that the PCAOB might take. There would be a series of rules of conduct in whatever state they might be practicing in, generally contained in the State and Accountancy Act or in the rules to that State Accountancy Act. And there would also be a set of code of conduct, a set of rules that is promulgated by the American Institute of CPAs, the organization that I head, that would also govern the conduct of a CPA from that particular standpoint. Those rules would generally be similar. There could be some differences depending on a public company versus a private company and things of that nature. And then you throw in the whole issue of fraud. And 10B of the fraud standards are related to the SEC also sets a whole level of conduct that the CPA must follow if they uncover fraud or they have a knowledge of fraud related to a particular client. And that, I'm sure, will vet out a little bit further as this goes along.
I think that in your answer you anticipated my second question, which was, in a nutshell, can you describe the standards of conduct? Obviously, it would be very difficult to do with so many standards, but perhaps you could address for us the question, bottom line, are these standards a difficult thing to comply with?
Well, from a professional responsibility standpoint, if we look on the ethical side, the principle is independence, obviously. Independence of appearance, independence of thought, independence in fact. And there's a whole myriad of interpretations and rules that go along with that particular issue. And they evolve, and they do get pretty complex. If we go way back in history, it was not a problem, for instance, for an auditor to actually own stock in a company that they audited. And that was many, many, many decades ago. Obviously, today, that is a prohibition. Firms have become very large and very complex, and as a result, you have rules about where ownership can exist, where conflicts exist based on the teams that are involved in a particular engagement. For a while, it was what offices, or it still is what offices. They used to have distance rules. Those rules have gone away because, obviously, we live in a much more interactive world, and it goes more to the engagement team look. So it's not so easy to pinpoint, you know, a single set or a simple concept, other than to say that the concept that overall governs the notion of an audit is independence, and the fact that the auditor sits in a unique position and is intended to protect the public, protect the investor by being independent of the company and expressing its opinion on the financial records of that company.
Thank you. Tom, I'm going to ask you the same two questions, again, just by way of background. What bodies of law and sets of rules generally govern the conduct of those practicing law before the SEC, and is it possible to give a thumbnail description of the relevant standards?
Well, Teresa, the fundamental regulation of lawyers is state regulation. Lawyers are licensed by individual states, and it is from those state licenses the lawyer gets the authority to practice law in any field. Those state rules applicable to lawyers vary among the states, so that, for example, a lawyer in New Jersey might have quite different obligations than a lawyer in California with respect to particular kinds of information. It's simply a crazy quilt, to some extent, of rules and regulations applicable to lawyers. There is a standard or model rule, set of model rules, that has been promulgated by the American Bar Association, but those are only models, and the states then adopt them. In addition, certain federal agencies, including the SEC, have promulgated rules applicable to lawyers who practice before those agencies. And in the case of the SEC, the obligations are general in terms of the general obligation of accuracy and honesty in the documents that are filed. And in addition, a series of regulations recently promulgated pursuant to the Sarbanes-Oxley Act that get much more detailed, and I expect we'll get into later. Essentially, the content is twofold, both at the state level and the federal level. One is a requirement that a lawyer not make a material misstatement of law or fact to anybody, any third party. That's in negotiation, it's in securities filing, or anything else. So there's a general obligation that lawyers be honest. Second, there's a general obligation that lawyers protect the confidential information of their clients. And the tension between the duty of disclosure and the duty of confidentiality is at least part of what the issues have been in recent years. And third, there is an obligation to protect the interests of the organization, the corporation, against persons within it who might try to take advantage of it. That is, people who either steal from the company or seek to defraud investors or whatever. And when a lawyer sees individuals in the organization taking advantage of the organization or creating potentially serious losses for the organization, then there's an obligation that the lawyer step in.
Barry, given your basic description of standards, I wonder if now would be possible for you to step back just a bit to talk about how you think accountants conceptualize their role in the capital raising process.
Well, as I said, I think we obviously there's a lot of notions that the CPA has. Confidentiality, as Tom mentioned, for the lawyers files into that as well. But The role of the CPA is an independent person looking at the financial records. The capital market system takes money, if you will, investors' money from a very disparate lot that are not close to the company in any way, thousands and thousands of shareholders. They make investment in the capital market system in the U.S., and they rely on the information flow to make those investments. Maybe they rely on the analysis of investment analysis people before they make those investments, but it's based on concrete, reliable information. That's the concept. So I think CPAs view themselves today and have historically viewed themselves as sort of the objective eyes on behalf of the shareholders, looking at management, looking even at governance, sitting between the shareholders and management, and opining on the accuracy and the appropriateness of financial information so that good decisions can be made. And I think when you start from that context, you can draw down on that, and you have to give some givens, I think. The U.S. has the most efficient capital markets in the world. Despite the difficulties that we went through in the last few years, we still have the most efficient capital markets in the world. And the reliability of information, the transparency of information, and the importance of that brings some efficiency, brings a significant factor of efficiency to that. So I think CPAs view their role in the financial reporting area as a pretty significant cog in that efficient flow of information, which reduces the cost of capital, which in fact enhances the investment grade of the investor public, and obviously helps to set up our capital market system to be successful. So that free flow of information has a reduction of capital component. The more people know about a particular investment, they are more likely to make a wise choice, and in the theories of free flow of information, people will invest in the best opportunities, the best companies, and things of that nature. So that's a very important role. Now, it's very difficult from an economic standpoint to put a dollar amount or quantify that specific cost of capital factor. But clearly, I think if you compare our markets around the world, the fact that we have that transparency and we do such a good job through regulation and the profession and corporate America, that we generally have a lower cost of operations from a capital perspective in the U.S. than other parts of the world. So that's a very important aspect to it. I think it's also changed a little bit from the standpoint that today in the area of Sarbanes-Oxley, we have very empowered audit committees. And so they view their role as working for the audit committee on behalf of the investing public. That is a position, for instance, that this profession has supported since the 1960s, but it's only really become a requirement with the passage of Sarbanes-Oxley, where the audit committee is the body, is the representatives of shareholders that picks the auditor and really sits between management and the auditor in that particular environment. So it's sort of a at a macro level, it's this efficiency of capital, supporting the transparency and free flow of information that makes capital move more freely as a very important role. And as far as the execution of that, it's through and with interaction with the representatives of shareholders, which are manifest by the audit committee.
Tom, do you think you could compare and contrast the lawyer's view of the of him or herself in the capital raising process?
I suspect it's fair to say that most lawyers don't take quite the macro view that we just heard. That is to say, most lawyers see their obligations as largely to, A, keep their clients out of trouble, and another way of saying that, B, adhere to the law. That is to say, the object of the lawyer is to help the client in the capital raising process by complying with the regulations of that process. Lawyers tend not to evaluate the quality of the investment or even the wisdom of providing certain information, for example. That is to say, if you're required to provide it, you provide it. But whether it's a good idea to provide it, whether people really know more as a result of having provided it, is not typically the question the lawyer asks. So in a sense, I think lawyers view their task somewhat narrowly. But this challenge of trying to figure out what the law really requires information is either superfluous or what information must be disclosed that the company doesn't want to be disclosed tends to be where the issues of professional responsibility for lawyers arise in the process.
One reads a great deal these days about the role of various gatekeepers in capital raising, and I've seen that term applied both in the context of accountants and in the context of lawyers, and it may be more appropriate with respect to one than with respect to another. We'll be following up on that. I'm curious about whether gatekeeper means the same thing as policeman. And Barry, I ask this of you first because I read an article not too long ago with the title, Accountants Make Miserable Policemen. Are they supposed to be policemen in the process? And if so, are they any good at it?
You know, I think policeman is not a very good metaphor in describing the role, because I think policemen mean different things to different people, and I think we have to sort of dice that up a little bit. I mean, clearly the concept of policeman could be prevention, it could be investigative, it could be, you know, things like crowd control and things of that nature. And so all of those have, you could make different relations in the financial reporting spectrum. From an enforcement perspective, there are a whole series of laws and regulation. Clearly the SEC has an enforcement responsibility, and has a role that you could equate to a policeman role as well. I like to look at it a little bit differently. Financial reporting has many different players in that role. And when we talk about financial reporting, we inevitably have to talk about fraud and the detection or maybe the prevention of fraud. But if you sort of want to equate it to the manufacturing process, if we were manufacturing automobiles, there are many, many components in that manufacturing process of design and engineering all the way through production and even quality control at the end. The fact is that the independent accountant is only one part of the financial reporting channel, if you will. There are roles for senior management, very important roles. There are roles for boards and audit committees. There are roles for regulators. There's even roles for employees and vendors and suppliers in that particular process. And yes, there's a check and balance role of the audit function that is part of that process. And we all have, every one of the components of that has a role in making sure that our financial system can be as good as it possibly can be. We would not go into a business, a manufacturing business, and simply rely on the inspection process at the end to determine quality. That's not how we would be competitive in the marketplace. And we can't rely on the auditor at the end to be the sole responsibility. It is an important part of that responsibility, but it's not the sole responsibility. And I think when you know, sort of the article that you cited about, you know, do they make good policemen, I think it implies a notion of, well, they don't necessarily catch everything. Well, policemen don't catch everything either. And there are a whole lot of attributes of liability and things that tie into this. I mean, we don't run around an unsolved crime. We don't necessarily point fingers at policemen for not having done their job correctly. There may be facts and circumstances that prevent the solving of a particular crime, if you're making that particular part of the analogy. So I think it's very difficult to make that particular analogy to the term policeman. I prefer to look at it sort of an entire financial reporting channel, and that everybody has to do their part to get to the positive outcome. One last point on it. One of the reasons why people say, well, maybe the profession doesn't do a good job on that, and it's a very unfair comment, is that we only hear of those bad situations, and we don't ever want a bad situation. Everybody wants 100%. I'm sure every leader in corporate America, because the vast majority of them are upstanding citizens, and they want 100%. They don't want fraud. They don't want misstated financial statements. But some do occur. The problem is because of confidentiality and because of the balancing of this information flow, there are so many times that the auditor has said no to things, has required other action to take place, that we will never know about. We don't ever hear about those items prevented. We only hear about those items that financial reporting channel did not prevent, and whomever is part of that process didn't prevent. Yet, all along the way, people prevent things and take the right action. But we have, as a nature of what we have, a situation where we only hear about the exceptions. So confidentiality, the information flow sort of prevents us from ever knowing about the thousands of examples where the right thing is done. We only hear about where the bad thing is done. And so people can produce an article and make that case, and it's probably unfair.
Tom, I've certainly read the same terms thrown around in the context of lawyers. Where were the lawyers as gatekeepers? Is it proper to think of them as gatekeepers and or policemen?
Well, I've never liked the term gatekeepers, but I think it can be understood, much in the context that Barry was describing. If you think of the process of capital raising as going, passing through a series of professionals, people describe the fact that you have to come to a lawyer and get a legal opinion or get approval of your documents before filing them as a gate that you have to pass through. But as Barry said, there are a whole series of these gates, and the mistake is assuming that any one of them is the enforcement authority. It's been said many times, I think. I remember hearing it when I was in law school, that the most effective enforcement of the securities laws occurs in a lawyer's office. That is to say, as Barry said, all those things that the professional advises the company not to do or says would be illegal and causes the process to change in appropriate ways. But having said that, that doesn't mean that most lawyers view themselves or should view themselves as primarily adversaries of their clients. Their object is to help the client achieve what the client ought to want to achieve, namely compliance with the legal requirements involved in raising capital.
I remember hearing that exact same quote when I was in law school. Maybe we had the same teacher. Now, knowing what I think the answer is, I'm going to turn the conversation next to the question of whether there have been any changes over time in our vision of what the professions should be contributing to the capital raising process. Barry, I think you've anticipated this a little bit.
There has been significant change. I think, as I mentioned before, the relationship with the audit committee, we have much more empowered audit committees. Clearly, the relationship between the auditor and the company is different today. There are services that are prescribed today under Sarbanes-Oxley that in the past the audit firm could do, and that's at an effort that, you know, Congress's statement, the SEC statement through rulemaking, that there should be separation of those so that there is not the appearance or the, in fact, conflicts of interest depending on the service. So that has certainly evolved over the last 4 or 5 years fairly significantly. I think another area that has evolved is sort of the getting it right notion. We have to remember that the financial statements are the company's financial statements. They're not the auditor's financial statements. They're management's financial statements. And the auditor expresses an opinion as to whether, and taken as a whole, those financial statements are deemed fair or materially correct. And throughout history, I think, or at least certainly recent history, the relationship of getting it right, having the consultation between the CPA, the auditor, and the internal CFO, CPAs in those roles, in understanding a very complex transaction and trying to figure out the right way to do it so that it gets presented correctly, which is generally the objective, then that has always been a consultative relationship. I think the environment that shifted in a post-Enron and WorldCom, post-Sarbanes-Oxley world put some barriers to that. And I think the expectations were that you know, management had to absolutely make its decision on what's the right accounting and the right answer related to a very complicated transaction. And then the auditor was purely a second look. And clearly, historically, the audit is deemed to be that second look, that second set of eyes. The problem, of course, with that is that different size companies, different complexity of companies have different relationships, and I don't think we really want in our financial reporting world a catch-me-if-you-can type of an environment. I think, you know, in virtually all circumstances, a more rational consultative process where the auditor can maintain his independence and objectivity, but that the consultative, the shared knowledge produces the best possible result, is in the end much better for the investing public. And I think in a post-Sarbanes-Oxley world, I think the pendulum shifted very far, and I think there's a lot of concerns in corporate America saying, you know, I can't get any type of consultative help in making some of these tough decisions for my auditor because they have to take this second look. And I don't think that that's in the best interest. I think today, I think people are beginning to recognize that maybe that shifted too far. And I think regulators at the PCAOB and other places are beginning to communicate, well, that's not really the real outcome that we wanted. Surely there can be a better positioning of that so that people can have that consultation and get to the right answer. And I think that that's very important because we can't lose sight of the fact that, you know, a huge percentage of the people involved in financial reporting want just that. They want to get it right. And, you know, being able to communicate about that is the better answer. We have a system in this country that is a catch-me-if-you-can audit environment. It's called the Internal Revenue System or the Internal Revenue Code. And people don't, when an IRS agent, an IRS auditor comes in, there isn't this sort of, well, you know, I really struggled with this transaction and do you think it was right? That type of information flow from an IRS audit perspective doesn't exist. It's more let the IRS agent find it. That's, if you were being audited or a company being audited, that's the approach. Well, that's not the best approach for financial reporting. It's much better to have that CFO, that person responsible for the company's financial statements, to speak to that auditor and say, look, this is a very complex transaction. These are the nuances that we're thinking about. This is where we don't see guidance. What do you think is the right answer? Point me and help me make sure I'm focused in the right direction to come to that answer. The auditor can do that, I believe, and still maintain the objectivity, that second look that independence requires. And as the result of that is better financial reporting. So we got to be careful that that pendulum isn't too far.
Do you see any pendulums, Tom?
Well, yes, I think it's fair to say that lawyers, speaking generally now, 10 years ago or more, had a view that their role was not only to help clients comply with the rules, but to comply with the rules. That is to say, to figure out where the rules were ambiguous and perhaps not go as far as they might in complying. I remember seeing a sports show the other day where one of the basketball players was demonstrating how to push another player off without getting caught. And I think there was a sense at one time that lawyers were in part to help you get where you wanted to be and just barely comply. It's really changed now. Lawyers have come to recognize, both from their own potential liability, we had a number of savings and loan cases, for example, back in the early 90s, where there was a substantial liability for lawyers as well as auditors in representing those companies. But we're seeing the same thing now in the corporate difficulties of recent years, where the clients clearly want to comply. That is to say, the Sarbanes-Oxley Act has thrown the fear of God into a lot of corporate managers. They don't want to go close to the line. The lawyers don't want to go close to the line. The name of the game is to do it right. As Barry said, I think lawyers are very much in that same situation. In terms of whether or not the changes in substantive regulations have been desirable, I think the changes in the ABA's model for the states has been extremely helpful. Lawyers were encouraged by the American Bar Association's advice to the states not to disclose certain kinds of information about their corporate clients because it was said to be confidential, even if it was not legally protected. That is to say, it wasn't privileged or there was no other legal protection. The company had an obligation to disclose it, but the lawyer could not disclose it if the client did not. The ABA has changed the rules now so that to the extent the states adopt those changes, and many are, lawyers will unquestionably be able to either disclose themselves or through the threat of disclosure cause their clients to make the disclosures that need to be made. The same thing, same kinds of pressures have been created by the Sarbanes-Oxley Act and the SEC's regulations. My own view is that the SEC's regulations are a bit more rigid and have, it's not that they make you disclose more, it's that they require you to disclose to particular people. If you disclose to the wrong person or you don't get a follow-up within a certain period of time, you have some potential liabilities. That seem to me to go too far and to fail to distinguish the wide variety of potential problem cases that lawyers may face. But apart from that, I think the move to increase lawyer responsibility for assuring that the client stays well within the legal bounds and doesn't try to find the loopholes is unquestionably the right direction to go.
Now, Barry, I didn't think that you sounded quite so I'm sure that you didn't sound so sure that the cultural change with respect to accountants had been such a good thing, that you thought perhaps it had gone too far. Do you think that this is society or the SEC telling us that lawyers were at one point so bad that they needed to be brought up to snuff, and that's been a good thing, but accountants had it about right in the first place and they've been pushed in the wrong direction?
No. I was only giving one example where this sort of this collaborative aspect. I think generally speaking, the changes that have come about from Sarbanes-Oxley have certainly changed the tone at the top in firms and in corporate America. As Tom mentioned, the fear of God notion that exists today, the liability notions and the personal liability issues that are for everyone in that sort of financial reporting channel, I think those are good changes. I think that there were a lot of things that have been brought in place, some of which is costly, like internal control reporting and the Section 404. I was just saying that solely as it relates to this process of dealing with complex issues, that a catch-me-if-you-can environment where there is a total separation might not produce the best result. The best result is with free information exchange and consultation so that the brightest minds can get to the right answer. So I don't think you characterized I was just solely looking at that particular point.
Thank you.
I'd simply pick up on what Barry's saying and say that lawyers have very much the same problem, if not a greater problem, in that we really don't train lawyers very well to understand the kinds of accounting issues that Barry's talking about and the kinds of finance issues that both of our professions have to struggle with. That is to say, creative financial management, in the best sense of that term, is desirable, and indeed one of the things that makes American companies stand out. It's when those creative instincts turn into deceitful practices that we have a problem, and if it's hard for accountants to figure out whether the financial and accounting is being handled correctly, it's doubly difficult for lawyers, and that is one of our continuing challenges.
And clearly the complexity of all of this, I've used that word a few times, but I mean, particularly large companies are, you know, they're in every business known to man and every country known to man just about. You know, you have diversification strategies both geographically and based on business lines. New types of transactions are being entered into, thought of, structured differently, constantly. It's not just a constant set of facts and transactions. Yes, a retail transaction buying clothes in a retail environment in a mall, yes, that's going to be a consistent transaction. But so many things are very complex today, from foreign currency to cross-border activities. And I think that it's important, derivatives, which is a very complex aspect today, I think it's very important to recognize that complexity needs to be handled in such a way that rational minds can get their hands around it. You asked about things that are different. For instance, what might happen in an audit committee meeting today? First off, audit committees are, under Sarbanes-Oxley, essentially required for all public companies. They're independent audit committees. They have to have at least one person with financial expertise. Those are all very, very good changes. But now the dialogue that's happening in these audit committee meetings are much different than what was happening pre-Sarbanes-Oxley. There's a greater vetting of the issues of the company. For instance, there is a discussion between the auditor and the audit committee about some of these complex transactions, about whether or not the auditor believes that the company's position is conservative or aggressive, sort of the point that Tom is making from that standpoint. There's a discussion about so-called pass adjustments that are not necessarily every adjustment is required to be made because of materiality or the like. There's a discussion about that. So there is an attempt at the communication side to have the audit committee, which is directly the representatives of shareholders, to have a more thorough understanding of sort of the things that were wrestled with between management and the auditor in that process, so that another set of eyes, other than just the auditor and management, is also weighing in on the type of transaction and the difficulties associated with it. That's a good thing. That's an iterative process that produces more dialogue and more decision making. You can't do that in the public domain. You can't do that with tens of thousands of shareholders. And audit committee members are that independent representative to sort of listen to these issues and also make a judgment call on it.
Do you think that we're likely to see more changes either in rules or in the cultures in, first of all, the accounting and then the legal profession?
Well, I would think if you wanted to go to Las Vegas, the thing that you could definitely bet on is that there will be more changes. the fact is that there are constantly new transactions, there are new types of entities, there are new opportunities that businesses face. So it isn't, I mean, the Financial Accounting Standards Board constantly looking at what's the right answers from an accounting perspective. Clearly a greater movement to what's called more fair value accounting. Those will continue to produce changes. The PCAOB, the profession itself, looking at auditing issues, how you move the science of auditing constantly with technology into the leading edge, those produce more changes. Regulatory components, legislative components, all create more changes. And quite frankly, in this environment, there is some pushback that's being debated in Washington and others that smaller companies are saying some of the rules are too burdensome. They don't allow me to cost effectively be able to access public capital. That might stunt my growth. And some of the jury is basically out, I think, on some of those debate points. But all of those factors mean that there will be a constant evolution. And I don't think you could pick any time in the history of financial reporting, auditing, or anywise that there hasn't been a constant evolution.
Now, Tom, I think that Barry already took care of this with respect to the accounting profession, but before you discuss whether any more changes might be in the offing, I'd be interested in hearing your view about whether there have been any changes in lawyers' relationships with their actual clients.
Well, I think this is the area that many lawyers worry about, and I think there has been, to some extent, a change in the relationship. The historic view that anything you told your lawyer wouldn't leave the room is changing now. There is authority to disclose information that you believe needs to be disclosed under the Sarbanes-Oxley regulations, for example. There's authority under the ABA model rule changes to disclose things that may relate to crime or fraud, and indeed an obligation to do that. And in the securities area, it's both crime and fraud if you're found to be violating the securities laws. So we are talking here about a world in which the relationship of trust, say, has been to some extent decreased, or it's hard to try to sum it up in a single word, because I think it's been beneficial as well to have everybody understand that this isn't a game anymore. We aren't trying to find out where the edges of the rules are. We're all trying to comply, and in that environment, then, presumably what you're telling your lawyer, you would be happy to have disclosed in that you, to the extent it's incriminating, it's not going to be, you're going to correct the situation rather than continue with it. But one of the areas that really is a a problem for many lawyers. And one of the reasons there is a debate continuing, particularly within state bar associations, about the appropriateness of SEC regulation in this area, is this concern that people will be less likely to be candid and with their lawyers because they fear that the information can and will be used against them.
Would you say that the changes in the rules have given us a new vision of who our client really is?
Historically, of course, we've said the client is the corporation, and I think that is still true. But it was inevitably the case, I think, or it certainly was the case, whether it was inevitable or not, that many lawyers viewed their clients as the managers of the organization. Those were, after all, the people who hired the lawyers. Those are the physical people that the lawyers talked to. And there was a concern that you make it comfortable for those managers to talk to you about whatever they wanted to say. It has always been the case that the lawyers have had, through their obligation to the corporation, an obligation to investors, not a separate obligation that's necessarily enforceable by a malpractice suit, but an obligation to protect the interests of the corporation and thus to serve the interests of investors. And certainly under the securities laws, compliance with those laws is a central part of protecting the interest of investors. So I don't think it's been a technical change in who our client is, but the sense that the client is a lot broader than the corporate managers either has become a part of the lawyers' accepted wisdom, or better, become part of it very soon, or the lawyers are going to be in trouble.
I think Tom's point, too, echoes the issue with the audit committee on the audit side. That, I mean, technically the shareholders and the audit function was always focused to the shareholder, the investing public. I think the changes that Sarbanes-Oxley brought about that really empowered the audit committee in that role makes it much more apparent that that is the role. And I think it goes to sort of behavioral change rather than maybe a technical change. It just sort of enforces the notion of it a lot better. I would agree with his assessment.
And Tom, if you were polishing off your crystal ball, do you see more changes in the offing?
I would be surprised if there were substantial changes in increased disclosure by lawyers substantial change in the role of lawyers. I think we may see what some will view as a pullback from Sarbanes-Oxley. Politically, that's going to be difficult, I think, because nobody wants to look like they're weak on ethics. But for the same reasons that Barry was describing, there is such a range of problems and companies that I think we may come to believe that the obligations that Sarbanes-Oxley imposed, the quite specific obligations, need to be made more flexible. There's an issue we haven't discussed at all, which is the relationship between lawyers and accountants. And that's very open issue nowadays. We've historically had a treaty, as it's sometimes been called, as to what information lawyers were to supply to auditors. And indeed every year in connection with the audit have to supply the information. It is a somewhat open question today whether that treaty, adopted now 30 years ago, is still in force or will be allowed to remain in force or will be changed in some way. And so that is an area of potential change that I think both auditors and accountants, auditors and lawyers, will need to keep an eye on.
Would you say there's active renegotiation right now, Barry?
Well, I think it's very important to understand that liability issues associated with a company are a very important aspect of the financial presentation of that company. And the as Tom called it, a treaty, the communication flow that existed in that environment is about the assessment of liabilities and what the likelihood of those outcomes are. It's management's responsibility to, again, it's management's financial statements to first make that assessment. And they do that, obviously, in consultation with lawyers, because they themselves are not, you know, in a position to make that legal assessment. And the auditor has a communication role with the lawyer to understand whether or not that assessment is appropriate, reasonable, if it has a potential to materially mistake, should be disclosed or not in the financial statements. And so obviously that's a fairly important piece of information for an investor to understand the liability risk of associated with a company as it relates to the ability for that company to proceed and, you know, be profitable in the future. The auditor himself is not a lawyer, is not in a position to make that legal assessment, and I don't think the lawyers want the auditors making that legal assessment. There's all sorts of liability risk associated to the professional that's involved in that process, be it a lawyer or the auditor. But we live in a very litigious society. There's, you know, very limited number of companies that do not have at any one time significant potential litigation out there that has to be assessed in the context of appropriate financial reporting, a contingency that exists there. And so while it's always, I think Tom is right, I mean, I think the world is changing and how do we make that work, but it has to work, I guess is what I would say, because it's just such an important part of financial reporting.
There is one other issue that might be worth mentioning, and that is the issue of the attorney-client privilege and auditors in connection with internal investigations. If there's been a situation in which the lawyers did an internal investigation at a company and the auditor says, I don't want to just know the answer they came up with. I want to know what you really learned. That is, show me all the interviews. If the lawyer gives that information to the auditor, which the auditor may indeed feel the auditor needs, there's a potential for losing the attorney-client privilege, and that is another area where, again, we're just identifying some areas where the law is not going to remain static. There's going to be a continuing discussion, and we'll simply see how it comes out.
Right, and that's a key element because obviously, if there is the auditor can face certain liability issues from a fraud detection perspective, et cetera, and to say they don't have access to that in making their judgments on the financial statement, that's a pretty significant scope limitation. And we certainly understand because we face it in the CPA profession, the liability side of things. In this case, Tom's describing a potential increased exposure to the company because of loss of that privilege. But at the same time, the auditor, you know, sort of gets offloaded some of that liability if they don't take access to it.
The point is, these are tough issues, and
they are tough.
And there will be continuing discussion of them over the years.
Absent another Enron in the next little bit, do you see things working themselves out quickly, or is it going to take years and years for these issues to be addressed?
Well, I'll start. I think it's important to understand that we're still in the infancy of a post-Sarbanes-Oxley era. I mean, it takes time for all of those things to sort of filter through the system. For instance, even on 404 reporting, internal control reporting, many companies can still have deferred implementation on those. The fact is that we're still, in the grand scheme of things, we're still relatively in the infancy of this sort of new regulatory regime. And I think probably the biggest mistake all of us could make would be to overreact, to make additional changes, or even to pull back where it might not be totally thought out. Our enterprise system is a very complex one, and so I think we need time to look at and study and have meaningful analysis of what the impacts are. So I would be one that would say too quick of a change would probably not be the right answer. That being said, I think you because of you have regulation through the SEC, you have standard setting through the PCAOB, that there are going to be the evolution of certain issues that people will want addressed and need to be addressed, and they'll do that through regulation and through standard setting. But as far as a massive change at say the congressional level, I think my opinion is that the attitude on Capitol Hill would be that might be a little too soon.
Yeah, I think the problem is that you need almost events, not that we need another Enron, but you need events that are dramatic sometimes to get people taking issues seriously. And yet I agree with Barry completely that what you get out of the processes that follow dramatic events often are not the best thought out. So I think we ought to expect that change is going to be constant in this area, and that we'll get some of the changes right, we'll get some wrong, and correct those hopefully over the years.
I'm interested now in asking a few specific questions of a fairly practical, what do you do kind of nature. Barry, let's say you've got a public client with off-balance sheet accounting practices that go somewhat beyond the merely creative. What do you do about it?
Well, you basically are implying, you could say that something is fraudulent there, in which case you have an obligation to raise that to management, to the highest level of management that's not involved in that particular environment. And probably require an investigation to determine if, in fact, if you have a suspect of it as opposed to a fact pattern, for sure, to make sure that it is not a fraudulent activity. If management does not take responsibility, does not act appropriately, the auditor has an obligation to inform the audit committee. Ultimately, and through a series of steps in this process, ultimately, if the board fails to take appropriate action, the auditor actually has a responsibility to ultimately resign the engagement and notify the SEC. And there's various steps in that process. The board has notification, and the board can take action and responsibility. All along the way, if it doesn't reach all the way to the end of that process, you have an obligation to assess the impact on the fairness of the financial statements that you're opining on as to whether that condition is changing the outcome. So if, in fact, it's not fraudulent, but you do not believe that it reflects fairly on the financial statements, then you could have an exception in your reporting or whatever on the financial statements themselves. So I think it's very important to understand that when you become knowledgeable of or aware of these particular issues as an auditor, you do have an obligation to raise the issue to the highest level not alleged to be involved, and you have an obligation to see that some appropriate outcome is taken. And ultimately, if no action is taken by the company, that there is a reporting responsibility to the SEC.
Going to the interaction of lawyers and accountants for a minute, Tom, let's suppose that you see an accounting practice that makes you scratch your head, but the CFO says it's okay. Assuming Barry is the outside auditor, do you call him?
Well, there are kind of two answers to that. Traditionally, under state law, I think lawyers' instincts would be to try to find the shortest route to satisfying themselves that all is well. If Barry is the outside auditor as opposed to a consultant, I'm not sure Barry can perhaps tell us better whether I can call him or whether he could answer in the first place about matters that were not connected directly with the audit. That is, that were simply transactions that came up in the course of the year. But what I'm trying to say is historically, lawyers would try to find the short route to the answer. If the auditor was that able to supply that information, that would be a helpful course. Now, under Sarbanes-Oxley, the lawyer's course would be to report this concern to the chief legal officer of the company, typically the general counsel of the company, although they call different things in different companies. And it would be the chief legal officer's obligation to prepare some kind of report that would satisfy the lawyer that all is well. That could be bringing in another accounting firm. It could be doing whatever they thought was appropriate, another law firm, something to satisfy the reporting lawyer that that all was well. That is an illustration of the change that I was raising some doubts about, because when you formalize it in this way, on the one hand, you do get a formula for getting a report back and making sure that you've got a documented demonstration that the practice is correct. On the other hand, it may be making an expensive process out of what ought to be relatively simple, and if the lawyer were able to be satisfied by just a phone call.
And Barry, flipping the picture, I think that you indicated earlier that if the auditor knows that an issuer is being sued for something like, say, an antitrust violation, you would ask the issuer's counsel about it, that you'd need to do that. Tom, if you're that counsel and you think the prospects for your client actually look pretty dim, what do you say or do?
Well, you're required, if you think that it's likely that you're going to lose, you are basically required to say that it's likely you're going to lose. That is part of what this treaty that I referred to earlier is all about. You don't say that if it's not pretty clear you're going to lose, because admitting it to your auditor in a context that is not privileged, or probably not privileged, is just an admission to the other side that you think you're going to lose, and affects very significantly, or potentially at least, what the case will settle for, or whatever. So it is a ordinarily the lawyer's obligation of confidentiality within a large range of possible success or failure in a case requires that the lawyer not provide very detailed information about the prospects of winning or losing. And that is an area of constant negotiation nowadays. There are audit firms that are requiring their clients to demand of their lawyers that they turn over much more detailed information. If, for example, suppose the lawyer has given the client an estimate in a privileged setting, given the client an estimate that it's a 70% chance you're going to lose, the auditor would want that information. The lawyer would not, under the treaty, be obliged to supply it. And the question of whether it ought to be supplied, whether it shouldn't, I can understand why the auditors want it, but you can also understand why the lawyers don't want to provide it, because not because of the threat to the lawyers, but because of the threat to the client and the risk that that it may genuinely affect whether the client wins or loses.
But also management has a responsibility to reflect properly their financial information. And so, you know, having the information of a high likelihood of being unsuccessful, management has to wrestle with the issue as well as to the appropriateness of presenting that liability or that contingency into their financial statements. And then obviously the auditor is being required to assess that from an audit perspective. And so it is somewhat, it's not just the two-legged auditor CPA role. I think under Sarbanes-Oxley, with these very significant civil and, in fact, criminal potential penalties as it relates to management, that it's really a three-legged stool in that particular environment today.
Well, there's no question that these are very tough issues, and this kind of illustrates why we're here. As I say to students each year, it's dangerous to be a lawyer. And I'm sure the accountants say the same thing. And as a result, there will continue to be these discussions of what needs to be disclosed and in what context and so on.
Speaking of penalties and what happens when you get things wrong and exactly what the dangers are, what kinds of sanctions might be applied against professionals?
Well, just very quickly, I mean, it can range from everything from under the rules of the SEC, an individual could be, in effect, disbarred from the SEC, not allowed to practice either permanently or suspended for some period of time under Rule 102E. Under the Sarbanes-Oxley Act, you can have penalties to the individual, you can have penalties to the firm. A firm can lose its ability to be registered with the PCAOB, which then means that it can't even do audits of public companies at that particular time. The civil penalties can range to the firm from, you know, really up to $15 million. So there's fairly large penalties. You have a whole set of state laws that come into play that have various losing your CPA license, penalty provisions that vary from state to state. Tom talked about the various bar rules. They exist like that in the accounting profession as well. So civil penalties, disbarment, criminal in some cases as well under Sarbanes-Oxley.
And all that's true for lawyers. And in addition, for both of us, the liability to the company or to investors is a major threat to both professions.
Barry and Tom, I'd like to thank you both for today's excellent discussion. I think we're just about out of time. I'd also like to remind our audience that this fireside chat is now archived by audio tape in the Society's virtual museum. The transcript of the chat will be ready soon. I'll be back as the moderator of the Fireside Chats for 2006, starting next March, and I'm pleased to announce that Pfizer, Inc. will again help to sponsor the series. Our focus next year will be on the critical roles of both the Internet and of the business decision makers in the capital market system. We'll be welcoming such panelists as John Reed Stark, SEC Chief of Internet Enforcement, Don Langevoort of Georgetown Law Center, an expert on behavioral economics, and Don Blandon of the Investor Protection Trust, discussing how the 50 states have used securities litigation settlement funds to foster investor education. Please join us again next year on www.sechistorical.org. Thank you for being with us today.